Reporting on the games you love by people who love to game. The MMO Reporter Network.
You, my friend, are listening to the Happy Hearthstone. This show is brought to you by Doghouse Systems, who make some of the best gaming PCs on the planet. If you want all the benefits of building your own computer but have no clue where to start, go ahead and let our friends take care of you. Check them out at doghousesystems.com and use the code MMOREPORTER for a free 128GB solid-state drive upgrade. And by Audible, the best audiobook program in existence. If you have any kind of commute or just wish you read more, I promise you this, Audible is the solution. Go to audibletrial.com/MMOREPORTER to download a free audiobook today. Hello and welcome to episode 87 of the Happy Hearthstone podcast, the longest running Hearthstone podcast in the history of space and time and cards. I'm your host, Andrew Brown, and this week I am joined by our good friend, Tony. What is up, man?
Hi, Andrew. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm doing better now that I am joined within the happy space by a fellow friend of the show.
Yeah, I came on, I don't remember what episode it was, but I brought the Yogg Hunter deck, which was fun to play, but did terrible on the show.
That's the thing about Yogg-Saron. When you got a card that is completely built off of randomness, you literally never know what you're going to get out of him. So,
oh, yeah. Yeah. It was crazy.
And that was pre-nerf, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was pre-nerf. So it would do things like, like Doom. And I draw a bunch of cards and then, keep going. And I would get Treants from Force of Nature, and the turn would end. And I had, a handful of cards. All of the creatures on my opponent's side were gone. And I had 15 minions or something. So it was really good.
Yeah. Before it got nerfed, it was being played basically at every tournament and every deck. Well, not every deck, but especially the Yogg Druid list was probably the most famous. But I did like the Yogg and Load lists, and I thought there was something to that Hunter list. That was pretty fun. Well, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. It was just a great way to, you're losing, and then you just flip the board and see what happens. So why not put it in your deck? It's like one slot.
Especially if you're losing, yeah. He could change the game and actually give you a complete board of 5/5s who have a death rattle that'll summon a 2/2. So
right.
Seems good. Well, Tony, for those of our listeners who may not remember, can you just give us a brief history of who you are, how you got involved with Hearthstone, and your interests outside of here?
Yeah, so I played Magic for, 15 years. And when I had kids, when I got a real job, and then when I had kids, it got really hard to go to Magic tournaments. And so I basically stopped playing, but the itch needed scratching, and I found Hearthstone on my iPhone, and it was like the exact same sort of impulse. The deck building, the cards, everything was the same impulse, and I realized that I could play without having to have a closet full of cards and without having to go to tournaments full of sweaty nerds like myself. So I was like, oh, this is a win-win. I can play in my PJs. Yeah, it was awesome. So that's how I got into Hearthstone. Outside of Hearthstone, I'm a lawyer during the day. I have two boys, and I run a website called Everyday Commentary, where I review and write news articles on everyday carry gear, like flashlights, pocket knives, pens, wallets, that kind of stuff. And I run my own podcast called Gear Geeks Live, which you can find at iTunes under Gear Geeks Live. And that's it.
And you talk about similar stuff that you review on the site on that show?
Yeah. The most recent episode, I was very fortunate to have a guy named Michael Walker on. And Michael Walker is the most, almost unquestionably, the most famous living knife maker in the world. And he's a recluse. Like he described himself as a hermit. He lives in the middle of the mountains in New Mexico. He makes 3 or 4 knives a year. They sell they sell anywhere between $50,000 and $180,000.
Yeah, that's something.
Yeah, that's all he does, and he's unquestionably a national treasure. And the only reason that people in the art world don't know is because people in the art world are snobby about knives. But he's amazing, and I was really fortunate to have him come on. That was my most recent episode. It was an hour and 10 minutes of me just being like, you are awesome.
Now, we have plenty to talk about, but I just have to ask, how in the world do you get a hermit onto your podcast? How does that work?
I have no idea. I was on Instagram one day, and I noticed that he had just jumped on Instagram. And I sent him a direct message, and I was like, hey, would you come on? And he's like, I read your stuff, sure. And I was like, what the?
Wow.
You read my stuff? Yeah, it was crazy. It was crazy. He is unquestionably one of the, like, so the knife magazine that everybody reads is called Blade Magazine. And he was, okay. he was in their Mount Rushmore of all-time great knife makers. And he was the only one that was still alive. I mean, he's incredible. I mean, he does things that no one else can do. And, you know, he'll show up at a show with like one or two knives. And when people know he's at the show, they'll travel all across the world. Like Russian oligarchs that collect knives will travel just to make sure that they're there to get a chance to buy one of his knives.
Wow.
He's really cool.
Really honest with you, I have no interest in knives at all, but I feel like I have to check this guy out if he's that much of a prodigy just to see what a $50,000 knife looks like.
If you can get one of his, so he makes this one called a zipper blade, which is his own invention.
Okay.
If you can get a zipper blade for $50,000, you have like an epic score on your hands. They're usually well over six figures.
That's absolutely crazy.
Yeah, he was.
That sounds like a lot of fun. Well, as we're moving into the episode, other than having a hermit, incredible guy on your show, why else are you happy today?
So my son is six, and he is learning how to read, and it is getting tantalizingly close to the point where he can play Hearthstone with me. He calls it the reading game.
Hey, reading game?
Yeah. Because there's so much.
Because you read your plays off to him? Or
no, because you have to read the cards.
Oh, okay. That's fun.
Yeah, yeah, so like he started watching me play right before Knife Juggler got nerfed. And so he knew the sounds, but he didn't know what they did. You know, so he knew, he says, I put an apple on your head. And so my son would keep saying, Dad, put an apple on his head. And then I said, that's not what he does. And I showed him, and he's like, oh, so you have to read what they do. And I didn't even think about it, you know, because like, you and I just know what they do. You don't have to worry about what the text says. But for him, he has to read every card. So
he doesn't quite know what's going on yet.
Right. He knows the sound cues and he knows the images, but he doesn't know what they do. So he reads every card when we're playing together.
Wow.
And that's hard not to make you happy.
Absolutely. Now, do you guys go through and read the flavor text also? Because that could be a full like dictionary workshop basically for him.
When they're really funny and they're jokes that he will get, we definitely read them. But mostly it's the sound cues, because he associates the sound cues, like the Knife Juggler one. And the other one that he always liked was the like ratcheting noises from Dr. Boom.
Mm, yeah.
And he knew Dr. Boom by name. He's like, oh, Dr. Boom.
He's pretty iconic when he was in every single game, in every single deck.
Yes. Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, I'm pretty happy because this past Saturday, I had a full day off with my family, which normally wouldn't seem like that big of a deal. But this was my first one we've had in about a month. I love my job, but it often has me going every which way and can really bite into my weekends easily. So my wife and daughter and I just loved having a day to chillax. I mean, literally nothing that we have to do. So you want to go grocery shopping? Let's go grocery shopping. You want to hang out and watch O Brother, Where Art Thou? Let's hang out and watch O Brother, Where Art Thou. So,
oh, that's a great movie.
Yeah, I forgot how good of a movie it was. I found myself wanting to relive the Odyssey the entire time and wanting to know all the tricks. But honestly, just on its own, it's a great movie. Yeah, and my birthday's coming up this week, so we're going to go celebrate that on Saturday by conquering an escape room with some friends. We're really looking forward to that. Have you ever done one of those before?
No. What is this?
So it's a room where you pay a fee, and typically you can have anywhere from 2 to 6 people in the room, and it's basically a real life mystery. So they've designed the room to tell a story and at the same time be a bunch, like, you have to find clues to kind of make your way through the story. So we did one once that was called like Area 51. So it was a scientist lab. There was a computer and there were some diagrams and books and stuff. And that's it. We had to find the code to get back through the door that we came in from. So we're locked out and we've got an hour to try and get out. And through it all, we browse through the computer. We find some documents of, a safe's code. And so we get in that safe and there's some Petri dishes that end up having numbers on it and stuff. All of it ends up leading to the back room where there's an alien body that you actually like put your hands through these gloves and have to make your way around and find like another number pattern or a color, or I think it was a word actually that ended up being a part of it. So it's pretty crazy and it's a lot of fun. The first one we did was just a little easy. So I said, I want to look around, do my research and find the toughest one in town. I think I found it. So I'm really excited about that. That'll be good.
So you're going to, on your birthday, you're paying somebody to lock you in a room.
Totally, man. What could be better than that?
That's really crazy.
It feels like a real life video game, but it's fun because like anyone can jump in and get it. But you really have to work together and think through it. And it's really good for team building. Like that's when we did it the first time, was for our work. We just got everyone together and we actually had 3 different rooms that were competing, and not going to brag or anything, but we got first place. So just saying.
It reminds me of those episodes of Star Trek that the producers called bottle episodes, where they didn't want to use any sets other than the sets already built, and they didn't want to use any guest stars. So they always put people like stuck in the holodeck or something, and you have to get out. You remember those? It's like, oh man,
I don't know.
Oh, they're like there's like always like 1 or 2 every episode or every season in any Star Trek, because they're always like way over budget. So they were like, let's pretend like the ship got hit by a thing that shuts down all technology. All right,
and
now let's see people.
That happened.
Yeah,
yeah, and I think they find a lot of their source like inspirations for their stories from stuff that they've seen on, TV shows or stuff like that. Obviously, Star Trek's a little bit iconic, so yeah. They probably pulled something from that. But you guys didn't here to come hear a pitch for escape rooms. You came to hear about Hearthstone. And my goodness, Tony, did you pick a good week to be on the show? Because we have got a ton of news to talk about, right?
Oh my gosh, it was crazy.
Some really exciting stuff too. So we're going to break it down. We really won't be able to hit everything because Tony's prepared a great main topic for us that I really want to dedicate most of the episode to, that all of you guys are really going to like too. I'll give you a heads up just so you know what's coming. I actually put it out there on the Happy Hearthstone Twitter and on our Google+ community asking what you guys really wanted to learn about on the show. I figured I could come up with a bunch of stuff that probably be fun and helpful and all that, but I really wanted to hear from you guys what you really wanted to grow in. And by far the biggest thing I heard back from you is how to build a deck. Just tons and tons of people were voting on there and saying that building a deck is something that you don't quite know how to do as well as you wish, and you wanted to get better at it. So Tony really graciously offered to come and hang out on the show and give his 2 bits about it, because honestly, I'm not, I really don't know this stuff that well. So I'm eager actually to learn quite a bit from him as well. So that's going to be our main topic. But first we got to talk about some stuff, including nerfs. Everyone loves nerfs, right?
Yay. Oh yes. These are good.
So these 2 cards will come as no surprise that they're getting the Nerf Bat. And Small Time Buccaneer has been the core part of this pirate package that's been going around. I know Patches the Pirate has gotten a lot of hate, and he's a seemingly, innocuous 1/1 minion that just pops out for free. But really, Small Time Buccaneer has been the problem, because as a 1-mana 1/2 that gives you +2 attack while a weapon is equipped, you're essentially getting a 3/2 minion for 1 mana, and especially rogue, especially shaman, And even the Pirate Warrior, it's really easy to get that turn two weapon after the turn one small time Buccaneer. Or with Spirit Claws, you could coin it out until now. But small time Buccaneer is probably getting, I think, a very fair deduction, and that's in its health. So instead of being a one mana 1/2, it's going to be a one mana 1/1. And that's really great news. Why are you excited about this one, Tony?
Well, so the idea of a one health minion in Hearthstone is really, really important, because almost half the classes are ping classes. Like they can do one damage with their hero power. And so taking small time Buccaneer from a two health minion to a one health minion doesn't decrease its power by half. It decreases it more than that. I mean, it's a significantly weaker card now. And that was the right way to nerf the pirate package, because there's really nothing you can do to patches. I mean, you either have that card with that ability or you don't. You can't make them a 0/1 because then it doesn't do anything.
I don't think so.
And you can make them cost 10, but it doesn't matter. So the only way to really limit the pirate package was to take small time Buccaneer. And I think the end result is this card is probably not playable anymore. I mean, it's just terrible.
I'm really interested to see if it is or not, because I agree with you, and yet I have to temper my emotions, because I know in the past I've said something like that, or I've said the opposite. I remember saying about Call of the Wild, where that was such a strong hunter card, but when it got up to 9 mana instead of 8, it really disappeared from the scene, and I thought 1 mana was not going to be that big of a deal for it. But all of a sudden, not being able to pair it with your hero power or with another card was a really big deal. So I agree with you that I don't think Buccaneer's going to be nearly as much of an auto-include. I think the pirate package is kind of going to be a thing of the past. But I think that you will still see it maybe in Rogue, especially. Just when you have that guaranteed turn two weapon and can have patches on the board still, I think it's really good. It honestly buffs Maelstrom Portal just a tiny bit too, which I'm not cranked about, because that card is so good, and even it getting a little bit better is sad.
That card is if there were four nerfs, that card would have been my fourth nerf.
I think so. Well, the other one actually was in the Shaman class as well, and that's Spirit Claws. So Spirit Claws is now going to be a two mana weapon with all the same stats and effect. And I think that this is really fair. You know, when this first came out, it seemed non-threatening, and I think Blizzard saw it the same way. The crazy thing was, in an ideal situation, you paid one mana for 9 attack, for 9 damage. You think about Fireball, which is 4 mana for 6 damage. That's just nuts. And granted, it has a lot of situational things that have to work out in order for you to get that. But it turned out it was a little bit too easy to get that with Bloodmage Thalnos, with Azure Drakes, stuff like that. So I think the two mana weapon, the biggest thing about this is that instead of getting your Spirit Claws on turn one and being able to totem and hope you get something, or Bloodmage Thalnos on turn two, now Spirit Claws is going to have to take up your two mana slot. Or it could be a great I think that if you play Spirit Claws on turn two, you're really taking a risk, because you're giving yourself a 1/3 weapon and hoping things will work out. And they absolutely could. But I think that Spirit Claws becomes a little bit more of a late game card for something like a mid-range shaman or control shaman even, because 2 mana for 9 damage is still really, really powerful. And I think later in the game, when you're able on turn 8 or turn 10 to combo it with a few things and get a guaranteed 3 attack, right off the bat, I think that it's going to find just a very different place rather than being just aggro shaman all the way.
I agree. I think that when they originally released the card, they had hoped to spur the creation of a spell damage shaman deck, but there just wasn't enough good spell damage stuff to make it the focus of the deck. And it works so well in an aggro shaman. It was like, why bother? I think that the thing that told me that this card was broken was the fact that it was at least as good as Fiery War Axe, and Fiery War Axe is probably one of the 3 or 4 best cards in the game. And so, like, if there's a card where it's like, it's not clearly worse than Fiery War X, and that means it's too good. The other thing that I would say about this card is that putting it in the 2-mana slot really disrupts the curve, because like if you have Spirit Claws and Thing from Below, you Spirit Claws, Hero Power, get 3 damage, kill their creature, Hero Power, and then the next turn you put out. There are very few decks that can take 3 hits of 3 damage and have a 5/5 on the board by turn 4. I mean, there's just no...
Absolutely.
It was too much. It was just too much.
I think that's right on the money, man. Well, the only other thing that's going on with this nerf patch is they're also changing some things about rank floors. And what I mean by that is through ranks 25 to 20, you're able to not lose stars whenever you lose a game. And they're bringing a little bit of that flavor to different achievements on the path to Legend. So now, starting with this patch, when you get to rank 15, you won't be able to go back down beyond that. So you won't be able to lose stars into rank 16 or 17. You'll still stay at 15 no stars as your bare minimum. Same thing for rank 10, and same thing for rank 5. I really want to hear what you think about this, Tony, because I've got a pretty festering opinion about this, but I want to hear a level-headed approach first.
So for me, the big deal is that this allows for people who want to experiment to experiment. What I typically do in a season is I skip the first 3 or 4 days because that's when everybody's like pounding to get to Legend. Uh-huh. And then I start playing decks that I have confidence in. And I usually by the middle of the month, I'm around rank 10. And then at that point, I kind of get bored. And so I'm trying to figure out, like, well, what do I want to do? And if I'm at rank 10 and I have a real shot of getting much higher, then I don't want to play those experimental decks because I don't want to go below rank 10 because then it gets really difficult because the number of stars. So from my perspective, this will allow people to experiment more. You'll see more fun decks on the ladder. But I also think that it does cheapen the run to Legend. Like being a Legend player now is not as difficult as it used to be. I imagine that we'll see something like, 20% more Legend players than we did before. Cause if you think about it, like, so one of the ways that like noobs got lucky and ran to Legend where they just like barely crossed the threshold of the last day of the season was they would have like these crazy win streaks. Like, I remember the highest I ever got was right after Ostakaka won the World Championships, he released his Secret Paladin deck. And that deck was like autopilot. It was so easy to play. Right. And I remember I had a streak of, it was either 15 or 16 wins without a loss. And I got way higher than I'd ever gotten before. And it was only because I think it was around a holiday. It was either Christmas. I forget when it was. Okay. Thanksgiving or Christmas. So I just stopped playing and then I forgot about it at the end of the season. But I've never come close to Legend, but that was the season that I could have. And if the ranked floors were to have been in place, I could have just sat at rank 5 and tried to hit a win streak again and then got over the hump. If you can win streak to 16 or 15 wins in a row from rank, I was at like rank 12. And so those 15 or 16 wins got me within striking distance of rank 5. And then I crossed the threshold of rank 5. Then I can just, putz around and play and then, rage quit until I get another win streak going and cross the threshold that way. So it does. Sure. I do think it cheapens Legend a little bit.
Well, now here's my thing, though, because let's say that you are at that rank 5 status and you can't win streak getting up to Legend. But you get up to rank 4 or get up to rank 3, but then you start going on a losing streak. You will go back down to ranks 4 and 5, right? If I read all that right. So this is my big problem with this. I don't want to smack talk this at all because I think it's a good thing. I just don't think it's really answering the problem that people have about the grindiness of the ladder. Because when I get to rank 5, which is typically where I'll land... I am purely happy that I've got my rank 5 chest, right? And that cannot be taken away from me. So that placeholder is already there kind of for what I'm going to get out of the end of the season. But as I continue to play, regardless of my progression, obviously I want to hit Legend. But the real problems aren't that I float back down to rank six. It's that even though I put in a ton of games, I can't seem to keep progressing, you know? So the right. one thing that this doesn't change is if I am stuck at rank six and I lose and lose and lose, I'll go all the way back down to rank 10, which doesn't feel good at all. And granted, that's a very extreme situation, but I actually had this happen this past week where I'm tracking my games and I found out that I had over 100 games where I floated at rank 8. So I bumped into rank 7 for a few games. I bumped down to rank 9 for a few games. But mostly I was rank 8 for over 100 games, which is, it's absurd, right? And my big thing that I started thinking about is what if there was something in place that just, after so many losses, there's some kind of mercy hold for me, right? So that could be if I'm losing 7 games in a row, maybe after the third loss, it just stops losing stars and it keeps me right where I'm at and then gives me an opportunity to make my way back. Now, if I win one and then lose another 3, I still keep falling, but that way, at least I'm not just, you know, debilitated that I can't break out of this wall. You know what I'm saying? So I hear you saying, see something like that in there.
Yeah, my only concern with that is that at the end of the season, the shenanigans that people can do with, like, the ladder, like, mm-hmm. you know, the roping thing where you start a sure. game at, you know, 5 minutes to midnight. And if you're losing, sure. you just rope it out. If they had the thing that you're saying where you stopped falling after a certain mm-hmm. point, mm-hmm. what people might do is they might run aggro decks. They might quit every game where they don't think they have a chance uh-huh. and then just play for streaks. Because, you know, winning 5 games versus winning 5 games in a row is like tremendously valuable. So there would be a way to game true. The That's system.
True. Yeah, I spent a lot of time thinking about this and like you can't ever guarantee those wins. So I don't know if, and I guess maybe there is some downside that I'm not thinking of. End of the day, I totally trust the team and what they're doing. But I think that that's really when the game starts, or like the ladder starts feeling grindy. And granted, they have said enough about it that I really believe they're working on some big overhaul of the system. I don't know that, but they've said enough to say that there could be a complete overhaul or something like that. So something that I'm suggesting here with a stop at a lose streak would be a temporary fix with the current system. I really wouldn't be surprised if we moved to some kind of a bronze, silver, gold, like Heroes of the Storm and Overwatch have. I think that that could be a standard thing across all Blizzard games that, you know, you're able to say, hey, I'm gold on this, I'm platinum on Hearthstone, and I'm, you know, Grandmaster on StarCraft II or something like that, you know. But we'll see. So all of those changes are going to go through with the next patch later this month. And in fact, as you're listening to this, there's a chance that it could be done. So we'll be eager to see those happen. And I'm sure Tony will be ripping Small Time Buccaneer out of each of your decks.
Yay! So. Goodbye.
So like I said, too much news to talk about. And actually, I just forgot about this until we started the show. But Tony, did you see the speculation about what the next expansion is going to be?
I did, and I think given the nature of the speculation that it is clearly not speculation. You know, when a voice actor accidentally leaks something and then takes it down and says, "And I had to do it because of an NDA," that's not speculation. That's exactly yeah. what's going on.
Absolutely. Where there's smoke, there's fire, and I think that there is enough to let you guys know that we're more than likely going to see this first expansion that comes out around April be some kind of Un'Goro-themed expansion. And really all you need to know about that is dinosaurs.
Sweet.
Are you excited for dinosaurs, Tony?
I have a 6-year-old son and a 2-year-old son, so I am perpetually excited for dinosaurs.
They're going to be jacked up about this expansion.
Yeah.
I think, I mean, we could speculate all day about it. That's really all we know at this point. I don't know a ton of lore. So unless you do, Tony.
Oh, God, no. I have no idea.
No, okay. We'll leave it to the other podcasts or you can do your own digging. Disguised Toast came out with a great video about some of all the information that kind of led to it. But if you're a WoW fan, get ready for going back to Un'Goro. If you're not a WoW fan, then get ready. New cards are coming and they're dinosaur themed. And that'll be great. So... The other big thing that was released is an entire blog post that Blizzard put out about the next set rotation. And this is really exciting because this last year they launched Standard, which was the first time that they were kind of rotating expansions out of normal play. They introduced the Wilds mode where you can play whatever you want. And we're coming up now on our second cycle. And this past year has been called Year of the Kraken. And now we are moving into Year of the Mammoth, which, my goodness, this blog post was a mammoth, right?
So it was crazy.
So to kind of give you a heads up with this, this will kick off around April, and that's when the next set will be released. So once that set is released, Blackrock Mountain, the Grand Tournament, and League of Explorers will all rotate out of Standard and into Wild, which everyone's excited about that because of one card, right, Tony?
Yes.
Which one is that?
Well, for me, it is Tunnel Trog.
Oh, actually, that's a really important one, too. I forgot. Tunnel Trog and Totem Golem are heading out. So Shaman's going to be struggling a little bit. The other one I was referencing was Reno Jackson.
Oh, I don't know if it's going to be gone.
You don't think it's going to be gone?
Well, you'll get to this later, but there's going to be some open slots.
Okay. I'm interested to see it, but he will definitely be moving. So it'll be interesting to see that. And so all of that will happen as the first expansion is released around April. So they're going to follow the same releasing content cycle in this calendar year. So around April, July, and December, you'll see releases. Last year, they said that they were going to do an expansion adventure expansion, which they ended up doing with Whispers of the Old Gods, One Night in Karazhan, and Mean Streets of Gadgetzan. But they've decided to change things a little bit now. So gone are adventures as we've known them. And we are going to have three complete 130 card expansions this year, which the bottom line for that is new and more cards, which is always great, right?
Yes. Yeah, that's always great.
The cool thing is I'm sorry?
I said it's painful on the wallet, but good for the game.
I think honestly there's more to that than they were willing to admit, but it makes good business sense to make you keep dropping on more packs rather than buy an expansion and you're done there, right?
Yeah.
So, but really the benefit for all of us is that we'll see more cards, we'll see more content. And the cool thing is that they're not nixing adventures completely. Actually, with each of these expansions, they're going to come out with single player missions, or otherwise known as PvE content, that's going to play kind of like adventures or quests. And those are going to be in each expansion that kind of help you explore the lore of the cards, maybe some characters who are legendary or something. They actually cited an example in the post about how they could have had some missions where you played as the Grimy Goons and you're going through the lackeys of the Jade Lotus and you finally get to Aya Blackpaw and, you know, you throw down or, you know, whatever the case may be. So it seems like these will kind of be similar to the Prelude mission in Karazhan, where all those single player missions are going to be totally free. Lots of details left out as far as like, will you earn cards from those? Will you get packs? Will you get gold? I would assume that they're going to have some incentives to kind of get you in the door. That's the whole free-to-play mentality, is if we give you a little bit, that'll get you going so that you'll get in. It's a good business model. And, but for all of us, free cards is never a bad thing, right?
this is so exciting. Like the idea that they're going to do, I mean, I love the adventures. They're my favorite thing deck building. They're my favorite thing. So the idea that they're going away is kind of sad. I mean, like, the chess one, the minecart one, all of those.
Oh yeah.
They were awesome. And like when you figure out the trick, you just feel so smart. And so I like those a lot. And like the Prelude mission in Karazhan was good, but it didn't have the same creative flair. So I trust them. I think they'll do fine and they'll make them awesome. But if there was going to be like a Grimy Goons versus Jade Lotus, that would be pretty sad because the Jade Lotus would crush them.
That's actually very accurate. So I'm glad we didn't have to do that. yeah, it'll be really exciting to see what they do, because if they're... you know, their team has grown and they're really taking that into account. Now they're able to do more. This is a great time to be a Hearthstone player, because you're going to just be getting more of what you love every few months. And the fact that we're getting more cards means that there's going to be more stuff to tool around with. There's going to be more stuff to tinker with on the ladder, new decks that are going to come out. I mean, this really is as good as it gets. So I think there's just rainbows and sunshine coming for all of us.
Yes, there's no downside here other than your wallet.
Yeah, and that's unfortunate, but we kind of knew that was coming. So another big thing from this announcement is they announced an alternate rogue portrait. So Maiv Shadow Song is going to be available when the next expansion releases. And is it he or she? Do you know exactly?
I think it's a dude. I'm not 100% sure. I know nothing about the lore. I've never played WoW ever. So
let's see. I'm looking for a her. It's a her, actually. So there you go. You wouldn't be able to tell because it's just a couple pairs of, or one pair of emerald eyes just staring at you. So, but it does say her. So we'll have to have somebody who knows more about it.
Definitely a her. Definitely a her.
But you're actually going to be able to get her completely free. So when the next expansion releases, you'll just need to win 10 games in standard, ranked, or casual at that point. So it'll kind of be your entry into a new cycle of standard. But I think it's just always great when they give something away like this just for playing the game, especially something that's so much fun and adds so much flavor and kind of gives you an incentive to try a different class like Rogue. It's just gravy.
Yeah, there's no downside here. I do think that some of the alternate characters were like way too difficult to get. Like, I'm not gonna buy. I just don't have enough time to go buy, or try WoW to get Leandra.
Oh yeah,
whatever. The alternate paladin one. Yeah. This one is perfect though. Like the more like this, or the one that supported the charity. Like that one was great too. Mm. But. Or the what was the Murloc one where you invited a friend? Those are really easy and achievable. But like ones that make you like, you know, saw off your left toe and it's like no.
That's not good, right?
No,
I will admit that I definitely jumped into WoW just because Lady Liadrin's so pretty in that portrait. But this will be great. So there's a ton of other info. We're actually going to hit one more thing before we close out the show, but we're going to point you to that blog post. So be sure. There's stuff like they're going to have daily rewards for logging in leading into that set rotation. There's going to be a stronger emphasis on real world tournaments around the wild format. There's just a ton of stuff in here. So be sure to go read that if you haven't yet. We'll be sure to have the link on the show notes. But man, that's a lot of news.
That's a ton of news. They did a lot.
Well, now it's our turn to do a lot because Tony, like I said before, you were so generous to come on and offer to really teach us deck building. Why is this an important skill for any player here?
Well, I think it's let me be candid. It is not an important skill to be a good player. You know, there are lots of players out there that just know how to play decks and they have somebody else build the deck for them. And a lot of pros know how to execute really well. So if your goal is to get the highest rank you can or to go through the ladder in 10 seconds, then you don't need to know how to build a deck. But if you want to have fun, then building your own deck and winning with your own deck is an enormous amount of fun. So that's why I think that it's important to know how to build a deck.
I think that's great. Well, take us into this, man. Teach me the ways, Sensei, because I am ready to learn.
Okay, so the first thing I would say is that all collectible card games have certain core things that are the same. And so when I came to Hearthstone, I came over from Magic, and a lot of the things that were really important concepts in Magic are really important concepts in Hearthstone. And so the first concept that every single player should know when they're figuring out how to build a deck or how to evaluate cards, which are two skills that are inextricably related, is mana curve. And so the mana curve is the way in which your mana is distributed over the game. And in the case of Hearthstone, unlike in Magic, you're given mana as a sort of automatic. In Magic, you had to draw certain cards that gave you mana. But in Hearthstone, whenever it's your turn, you get a new mana crystal unless it's after turn 10. Mm-hmm. And so what you want to do when building a deck is you want to keep this mana curve in mind. And that is that it factors into two things. First of all, you have to think about what turns are you guaranteed to get. There are no decks in Hearthstone that will kill you on the first turn. There are decks in Magic that would kill you on the first turn. Like,
unless you played this last Tavern Brawl.
Right.
If you can cheat out the game based off the rules like that.
Right, right. But if you're on the ladder, there are no auto-win decks. You know, like in Magic, there were auto-win decks where the other player either... you just didn't get to go. You know, like if you got the right hand, it was like a lay down in Euchre. You just showed them, you know, like I have Channel, I have Fireball, I have Black Lotus, I have Mountain, you're dead. You know, and So there are no turn or there are no games in Hearthstone that will get beyond, that won't get beyond turn one, turn two, and usually turn three. I think there were some decks before before nerfs in the early beta where they could get close to killing you on turn three or four with Warsong Commander and Baloney like that. But You're going to get a turn one, two, three, four, and probably a turn five. And so with that in mind, you should have more cards in your deck that can be played on turns one, two, three, four, and five than you should cards that could be played only on turns eight, nine, and 10. So keeping mana cost down and distributing cheap cards across the mana spectrum is important. That's the first thing in understanding the mana curve. The second thing is you have to think about what your cards will do after you've maxed out your mana crystals. So if you're saying to yourself, I want to be able to play a card on every turn, then you should put all one cost cards in your deck because you'll always be able to play them. But That doesn't work out because one cost cards kind of stink. And so like, there's nothing worse than drawing your small-time Buccaneer when your opponent has a Ragnaros out. And you're like,
that doesn't help me.
This guy does nothing. Yeah, this guy doesn't do anything. At best, he's a bullet blocker.
Right.
You should build the mana curve knowing that you're going to get turns one through five, but also knowing that after turn 10, you might draw a crappy card that costs one mana. So sprinkle them in along the bell curve, like the bell curve from statistics. Mm. And so you want a few cards at the low end of the mana curve, the 0, 1, and two slots. Mm-hmm. You want more at 3, more at 4, 5, and then go down, you know, like you're going down the hill on 6, 7, 8, and 9, and then 10. And if you do that, when your cards are randomly distributed, as they are when your deck is shuffled by the computer, then you're more likely to get a card that you can play on 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. And so that's the first part of the mana curve. The second part...
How many of these like really big cards do you want? Because, you know, the bell curve, like, do I need to have a 10 drop in my deck? Or can I get away with just some 6 drops? Or like, how do you approach those big cards like that?
So the first thing is you have to figure out what kind of deck you're playing. So like if you're playing Ramp Druid, then putting a 10 cost card in your deck is not that much of a penalty because you're often getting to 10 mana.
You're trying but to if get you're there.
Yeah, but if you're playing something like compare Dragon Warrior to Dragon Priest, where Dragon Warrior is more of a tempo deck than Dragon Priest. Like Dragon Priest is a tempo deck as well, but it has control elements. And so it's not crazy to put something like a Ysera in, whereas there are very few Dragon Warrior decks that run Ysera. They usually top out at Draconid Crusher, which is a 6 mana card. So the answer to your question about how many big mana cards you should put in your deck depends on the deck itself. If it's a control deck or a slower deck, then you could put more in. If it has some sort of ramping effect, you could put more in. If it's a mid-range deck, a tempo deck, or an aggro deck, then you probably don't need them that much.
It's really interesting. I'm actually thinking a lot about Arena as you're talking about this, and because Arena is all about building a deck. And granted, there are some big constraints because you're limited on what you're able to choose. But that bell curve was one of the first really big pieces of advice that I got as far as how to build a successful Arena deck. And granted, even Arena deck, sometimes you get an aggro list or a control list, mid-range. But that's usually a really good model to go off of. If most of your cards are kind of in that 4-mana range, there's a good chance that from your mid to late game, you're going to have enough steam to get some big bodies on the board who are able to do something or some good spells that are going to be able to flip the game for you.
Yes, that's definitely true. And if you look at like, what's the site called? Hearth Arena Tiers, where they break down all the cards and they've done like statistical analysis. You'll notice that there are very few cards on that tier list that are in the top tier that are like really, really super expensive. And I think that's a good rule of thumb for any sort of deck building. If you have a choice between, if you have like an open slot and it's between like a 10 mana card and a 4 mana card, always go with the cheaper card. There's, I mean,
I think the only other thing I would add is that the mana cost doesn't necessarily necessitate how powerful a card is also, right? So a 10 mana card will probably do more overall than a 2 mana card, but a 2 mana card could be more effective for what your deck's trying to do rather than just the big beefy bomb that doesn't really add anything, basically. And granted, there are very few 10 cost cards you have to worry about, but...
I mean, the perfect example is comparing the pre-nerf Knife Juggler to something like Mind Control. Like, Knife Juggler was a 3-2 for two, and when a creature came, or when a minion came into play, it did one random damage. And the impact of the random damage at that early in the game could often win games all by itself. You would, you know, like, if they had like a couple of guys on the board, you played an Unleash the Hounds, you killed all their guys, you attacked for three, and then you attacked with your hounds. There's very little that's going to come back from that amount of destruction, and it's only a 2-mana card.
Wow.
So the second thing about mana curve that I wanted to point out is something that people don't think about all the time. Hot Meowth said that if he won World Championships, he was going to reveal a secret about how to play Hearthstone that helped him win. I don't know what that secret is, but I have a feeling that it has to do with something about mana utilization. So if you think of your mana curve as like a bell curve, that tells you how to build your deck, what cards to include. But if you think about your mana in terms of a resource in the game, it is actually sort of a logarithmic slope, so that you have one mana on the first turn. And then on the second turn, you've had access to three mana. And then on the third turn, you've had access to six mana. And so it goes up and up and up. And if you keep track of the mana that you spend over the game, other than your life totals, I have found that the number one correlation to who wins is who utilizes all of their mana or the most of their mana throughout the game. So the guy that utilizes all of his mana on turn one, turn two, turn three, turn four, so on and so forth, that person is almost always going to win because they're playing their most high impact card at the best time. Each time. And so I don't know what his secret was, but I, for some reason, I think that might have been related to the secret.
That's good. Now, the only thing I'll throw back at you is, especially when we live in a time when Reno Lock is as powerful as it is, that deck has so many answers, right? It's got Black Blast Crystal Potion, Shadow Flame, Twisting Nether. I mean, just so many ways to clear the board. Doomsayer. And the only thing I'll say is that if you're going up against a deck that you know it can be super oppressive in clearing things out, don't be so excited about dumping your hand every turn. Because when I'm in that Reno Lock matchup, I have to be very careful about what resources I'm using. I want to have a presence on the board, but I don't want to put everything down if he hasn't played his Twisting Nether yet and we're going into turn eight. Because there's a really good chance that if he's going to get a lot of value off of that, he's going to do it, right?
Yes. And so that's a good point. So like the deck I'm thinking about for utilizing all your mana throughout the game is something like Dragon Warrior. So in Dragon Warrior, you know, like the Dragon Warrior right now runs the Pirate Package. It runs Alexstrasza's Champion. It runs Fairy Dragon. So like ideally what you would do is you go turn one, Pirate, Patches, you know, attack with Patches, attack with, you know, Nazoth's First Mate, the Rusty Hook thing. Then turn two, you know, Alexstrasza's Champion. Turn three, you drop the Frothing Berserker. Turn four, Korkron Elite. And so you're not necessarily dumping your entire hand because of exactly the point you made, which is you need to hold something in reserve. But you're hitting each point in the game with the right card so that your curve matches up with your mana utilization throughout the game.
That's really
that way
good.
you're not like doing like the on turn four, it's terrible. It's not terrible, but it's less ideal to go two Fairy Dragons than it would be to go Korkron Elite because you're holding something back in your hand to trigger dragons. You have something in case they have, you know, Twisting Nether and wipes the board. So that's, you know, it's not just simply use all your mana every time. It's if you use your mana every time and you make good plays, it's really hard to win when they're utilized, when your opponent's utilizing all their mana throughout the game.
Sure. And you kind of reference an idea, because there's value in a fairy dragon that's not necessarily in the Korkron Elite, depending on what you're trying to do with your deck. So a great example right there that you might want to hold on to it, because there's value of holding on to a fairy dragon. So what else would you say as far as like the value of cards and how to kind of look into that as you're crafting your deck and deciding what's going to make it and what's not? Because this isn't, I think Magic, you are allowed to go over the deck minimum, right?
Yep.
You could have a 200 card deck if you wanted to in that game, but Hearthstone, very simple that you must have 30 cards. And with, you know, as that pool continues to grow, it's probably going to get even harder for some of our listeners to really determine what I want to put in here. So how do you analyze the value of different cards?
So there's two things that I point out for figuring out the value of cards. First is that there are cards that have static values, cards that have partially contextual value, and then cards that have completely contextual value, where okay. There's no way to predict how valuable they're going to be. And so like if you take the examples one at a time, like a static value card is something like River Crocolisk or Chillwind Yeti. You know when you play it, it's going to give you, the Yeti's going to give you 9 stats for 4 mana.
No doubt what it's going to give you.
Right. Yeah. And then if you have something that's like a partially contextual card, it's like Blackwing Technician. You know that in the right circumstance, it's going to give you 8 stats for 3 mana, which mm-hmm. is good. And then you have a card like Jade Lightning, or the most contextually valuable card of all time, which is Yogg-Saron.
There you go.
where you have no way of predicting how valuable it's going to be. Like mm-hmm. I put a Jade Lightning in my deck and I know that it's going to give me 4 damage and 2 stats, but I don't know if it's going to give me more than that. Where, you know, right. And then you have Yogg-Saron that gives you pretty much whatever could ever happen like. In the game.
He's a little temperamental guy, you know. He's had a bad time as an old god, so he wants to take it out on you.
he has asparagus tentacles, so he's going to be.
He has to, right?
Yeah. So the other thing about figuring out the value of cards is trying to figure out like what are the things that you're getting worth. And Scott Lance, who did the show with Scott Josh, he talked mm-hmm. about the vanilla test. And the vanilla test was the Chillwind Yeti. You got 9 stats for 4 mana. But if you look at the game, you'll see that there is a conversion rate for almost every resource you have. And if you think about it like this, there are really 5 basic resources. There's your life / armor. Mm-hmm. There are cards in hand, cards in deck, and then attack and health. So every one of those things has a set value, and every one of the ways to cheat that set value is a good deal. So like, mm-hmm. for example, Innervate. Innervate shows you that at the very best, a card is worth 2 mana, because Innervate costs 0 mana. It costs you a card, but you get 2 mana from it. Right. And there's no other place where you get just a blanket convert one resource to another like that with mana that is more efficient than Innervate. Mm-hmm. And so when you're looking at cards trying to figure out how to build a deck, you have to figure out those cards that cheat the conversion rate. Innervate's a good example. Another good example is comparing something like Frostbolt and Fireball. Fireball gives you the 6 damage for 4 mana. Mm-hmm. Frostbolt gives you 3 damage for 2 mana. Mm-hmm. But it also tosses in the free freezing.
Freeze, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so in a sense, Frostbolt is a more valuable card because you're getting the same amount of damage on a ratio basis, but you're getting a free ability thrown in. And you can go through and you can price out all of the values of all of the cards using this idea. And if you have this idea of converting resources and the conversion rate for resources, coupled with understanding contextual value and partially contextual value and static value, then you can figure out what cards are really good. And I think that one of the best examples, and I put this in the show notes because it was really striking when I sat down and broke it down, mm-hmm. was something like Dr. Boom. So Dr. Boom is a partially contextually valued card because you don't know how much the boom bots are going to be worth.
Sure,
you know
sure.
what the high roll is, you know what the low roll is, but you don't know exactly what they're going to be worth.
And you have no control over it either.
Right. And so when you think about it, you're like, okay, so Dr. Boom is 18 stats for 7 mana. That's not that bad. That's pretty good, in fact. And it's, you know, a little bit below the 9 stats for 4 mana that you're getting with Chillwind Yeti. Mm-hmm. But what you don't realize is that on average, you get 5 damage from the 2 boom bots. Mm-hmm. And so 5 damage is actually worth something like almost 2 completely free arcane missiles.
Okay.
So that's an extra 2 that's an extra 2 mana. And so what ends up happening is you take the, you know, you look at the stats that you have. You have the 18 stats. Mm-hmm. You've paid 7 mana for 18 stats. But what you're actually going to, you can actually do is you can deduct the cost of the 2 arcane missiles. So 1 arcane missile is 3 mana at random, mm-hmm. or 3 damage at random for 1 mana. And here you're getting 5 damage at random for however much mana. So now you take that 18 stats at 7 mana and you subtract the 2 arcane missiles and you now get 18 stats for 5 mana, which is bonkers.
Yeah.
Yes.
And
so that... Go ahead.
Just to kind of break it down a little bit, would you say that you really want to balance whether a card, like how many of these, I can't remember the exact wording, contextually, you're using cards above my words above my pay grade, like the Jade Lightning, the contextual value cards that you don't want to have a whole deck filled with these, right? I mean, even like your Yogg-Saron Hunter, like Yogg really was the contextual card, right?
Oh yeah, yeah. I think that one of the things that happens is that so like think of it like just pure random chance statistics.
Uh-huh.
If you have the chance to get the high roll and you have only one roll,
mm-hmm.
then your chance of hitting the high roll is lower. But if you have multiple chances to get the high roll, then your chance of hitting the high roll is better. And mm-hmm. so I think that if you build your deck correctly, you can really maximize the value of contextually valued cards. Like
okay.
the Jade Package is a perfect example. It is very hard to get value out of the Jade Package if you only have a few.
Sure.
So you want to maximize them. And the same thing is true with stuff like the dragon package. If you want to really get the best value out of dragons, like Dragon Priest, you have to have a lot of dragons. And so I think that the game is moving away from cards with really crazy static values,
mm-hmm.
and it's moving towards cards where synergies produce really high values, but they're always contextual. And so
sure.
I think that in the beginning of Hearthstone, it was what you're saying is true, that you don't want your deck to be entirely dependent on these contextually valued cards. But I think as the designers have moved forward and they don't want to do power creep where one card is obviously better than another,
mm-hmm.
the way that they can avoid that is doing what they called sideways design, where they branch out and say, okay, if you really commit to this strategy, you can just push everything and you get, you know, 5 or 10 chances at the high roll,
right?
And that makes your deck better, that makes your cards better.
Hmm.
So and I think that, go ahead.
Oh, I was thinking that the other thing to take into account is what your goals are, right? If you're just trying to have fun, like fill your whole deck with contextual cards, right?
Right.
It's even important to know how to build a deck. If your 100% goal is to have fun with it, you want to put the most fun in here. And I think that, you know, whether you are trying to build an RNG heavy deck and you just want to see what happens, or kind of like one of the decks Josh brought on the show on his last episode with the value heavy priest deck.
Yeah.
it's not so much about cards that really make sense. It's about like what cards are you going to have fun playing and that have powerful effects at the same time. That deck wasn't necessarily bad because it was doing exactly what he created it to do. You know, he's probably not going to have a great time on the ladder with it, but man, those games where he wins are going to feel really, really nice.
Yes, that is definitely true. Like one of the decks that unfortunately, it's hard to claim credit for a deck in Hearthstone because
sure,
so many
sure.
people are working to solve the problem. But I had the Kuhn-Cthun Aviana deck.
Oh, yeah, that combo.
Yeah, I had that deck designed and built within like 2 or 3 days of the release of...
Oh, man, right at the beginning.
Yeah, except it was like 2 cards off, and ironically, one of them was the Brewmaster. Like I had Youthful Brewmaster,
oh,
and
yeah.
thinking like,
uh-huh.
oh, he's so much cheaper. But it doesn't matter because you're only playing that card after you've played Eviana. So you you can get the big fat guy because he's going to be one mana too. So I was really proud of myself that I got so close to getting the optimized version of that deck. Even though the deck's not great, it's still fun. And it's a perfect example of how you put all of these cards together and you sort of exploit all of their really efficient resource trades and resource conversions to make the deck do something that it really should no deck should be able to do what that deck can do when it goes off. I mean, it's crazy.
But the reason that deck works so well, when it works, is because the entire deck is built around doing one thing, right? And that's what all combo decks are around. It's not necessarily getting value every turn. It's setting up either a single turn or maybe two turns where the amount of value that you're getting is so overwhelming that you either kill them in one turn or you're able to take them down in a couple. I mean, really, every deck's trying to do something, and it's really important to build around that, right? I mean, like, how important is it to find those cards that are synergetic with each other when you're building that?
So this is a really interesting point. So right before Mean Streets came out, Reynad, who runs Tempo Storm and is a really great deck builder, one of probably the two best deck builders in the community, along with Jackie Chan. He had this rogue deck that was just like aggro rogue, and it was one of
those tempo rogue.
No, it had no cards over three mana. It was crazy.
Oh wow!
Oh, and Leroy Jenkins, but he played it on stream and he put it out there, and it was basically just like you looked at this deck, and I had like Lowly Squire and all these cards that are like just garbage.
Weird.
And
then
you played it and you realize like, okay, so Lowly Squire is always a 2/2, and a 2/2 for one is good. And then when you play Lowly Squire and you play Bladed Cultist, then the Bladed Cultist is a 2/3, and now you have a 2/2 and a 2/3 that can attack on turn two with the weapon. Yeah, and so like it was just one of those things where it built on each other, and the Aviana C'Thun deck was the same thing. Like what it did was it took like the really obvious synergy of the C'Thun mechanic, and it put it with this crazy three card combo that like if you get the combo, it's virtually impossible to lose. Like I've never gotten the combo off and lost the game. So the synergy is the way to take advantage of what I said before about the sideways deck or sideways card design. They're not making just purely broken cards. They're never going to make like a 4/4 for two, but with no drawback, but they are going to make, you know, a 2/2 that becomes a 4/4 if you do X, or like, you know, Blackwing Technician. It's a 3/3/5 for three if you have dragons. And so you put that in a deck with all the other dragons and it becomes much, much better. Hmm. And, you know, looking for the synergies is not just going through and doing like a control F for like all the Jade cards. It's doing what Reynad did with the Lowly Squire and the Bladed Cultist, you know, finding cards that play well off each other. Like the C'Thun Aviana combo was something that I was just like, as soon as I saw that card, I was like, that is what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. So the synergy is what makes a deck a really good deck.
And it's important to look outside of those expansions, right? Like one of the biggest sad things to me about that Aviana C'Thun deck is that it took until right before Aviana is about to rotate out for us to get a card in C'Thun that really like finally let her have her day where she can do something, right?
Yes, that's super sad. It's super duper sad. And, you know, like it was fun to play that deck and it felt sort of like Patron Warrior when Patron Warrior went off. Sure. But, you know, the Patron Warrior is the ultimate non-keyword synergy deck. Like if you think about like the decks that we have now, it's like, you know, find all the Jade cards, put them in a deck, find all the C'Thun cards, put them in a deck. But like the guys that pioneered Patron Warrior when it was the Warsong Commander version, I mean, brilliant, and playing it was hard, but it could do anything. I mean, that deck could win at any point.
Probably the most complicated deck we've ever seen, I would argue.
Oh, no question.
But
no question.
Like not easily accessible, but man, if you know how to use it, it's just nigh unstoppable.
Yes. And it was because they took advantage of all the synergies.
That's great. Well, what else you got here about building my decks?
Yeah. So the one thing that you want to think about for a deck is you want to think about how to close out a game. And sure. So in Magic, there were often times when the game would just grind to a halt where both players, you know, like one player couldn't kill the other player, but the other player couldn't do anything. Mm-hmm. And so those kind of stalemates made certain kinds of Magic unfun to play. And they don't really exist in Hearthstone because Hearthstone designers have created a number of different cards that provide what I call reach or burst, where you can put yourself out of reach of an opponent, or you can burst damage, or what Ben Brode in his most recent post said, spike damage someone down. And if you think about it, the perfect spike damage card is Leroy Jenkins.
Sure, you know, sure.
Out of nowhere, punch in the face for six. And like, how many times have those dragon whelps ever mattered? They never matter, right?
You're not
like
playing for him to use them.
Right, right. So that's the perfect burst damage card. And then the perfect put you out of reach card is the one that you talked about, which was Reno Jackson. You know,
right, right.
You're like, I like playing the Reno Mage deck, and it's often just like soul crushing when I play a secret and they know that it's ice block. They get me down to one, it pops the ice block, I have another turn, and then I play Reno and it gives me all my life back, you know, and it's just like, oh, I can't do it. It's the game is over. Like,
right,
there's,
right.
You know, I haven't killed them, but there's no way for them to win. And so when you're building your deck, it is always helpful to figure out, how am I going to actually end this thing? Mm-hmm. And most decks, you know, Dragon Warrior being one of the few exceptions, most decks have one or the other, the thing that puts them out of reach or the thing that just closes the door.
Sure.
And so, you know, like, Miracle Rogue has Gadgets and Auctioneer, mm-hmm. or Edwin Van Cleef. You know, the Aggro Shaman has 15 of those cards. Like
Lava Burst, Lightning Bolt, Jade Lightning.
Yeah, Lava Burst, Lightning Bolt, Jade Lightning, Tunnel Trog, Faceless, Flamelith Faceless.
Basically, I mean, it's just, everything.
Right, right. And that's one of the reasons why that deck is so good, is because it just has so many cards that just mm-hmm. put it out of, you know, put it out of. And the other thing is, like, it actually has a put you out of reach card in the Spirit Wolves. You know, like, if you have
sure.
If you have a certain hand, you can do, you know, like the Tunnel Trog, and then Totem Golem, and then Coin Spirit Spirit
feral
Wolves.
Spirits,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, Feral Spirit. And then, you know, like, not only can they not reach you because you have two taunt minions mm-hmm. in the way, but they also have this giant army of guys at you.
And especially if you're going up against a pirate warrior, that will shut them down immediately.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, so they can get through it, but they're going to have to sacrifice a lot to get there.
Yeah. And it's by that time, it's pretty much always done. A couple other things to think about, the idea of versatility versus consistency. Mm. And so, like, when you're building a deck, you have to figure out what kind of deck suits your play style. I am a person that really values consistency. I want the deck to do the exact same thing every time, no matter what. I'm not a person that likes to pull off these really exotic, weird ways of winning, even though I do like the Reno Mage deck, which is, you know, probably the very epitome of mm-hmm. versatility. Mm-hmm. You have 30 one-ofs in the deck, so you can do a lot of things. It's a very flexible design. But at sure. the same time, it's not as consistent as I'd prefer. You know, I like to play on the ladder. I like to rank up on the ladder, mm-hmm. and I want to do it in a way that does not require me to, you know, go to bed with a migraine. I want to win. I want to win the same way. And so, like, compare something like Pirate Warrior, which has a huge amount of consistency,
sure,
versus something like Reno Mage, which has very low consistency but very high versatility. And so, those are the things. That's a question not about how to build a deck, but how to build a deck that you want to play. And I've right. always valued consistency over versatility. But, you know, if you're a guy that likes to do long division in your head, then go for the versatility.
Go for the math warrior old school. Well, actually, I guess I think that relied on charge, actually, which has since been nerfed into the ground. So
correct.
Maybe not. Is there any way to get versatility and consistency? I mean, that's the easy question to ask, but I mean, what do you think about finding a balance? Do you need to go one way or the other?
There is, and it's called Play Druid.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, like, if you remember the old before the nerf to Force of Nature, that deck had like how many choose? It had at least four choose cards. And so like, okay, if you have four or five choose cards, you essentially have, instead of, 30 cards in your deck, you have 40 cards in your deck. Cause you have, you have, five cards times two. So that's 10 that all have two effects. So they're, take up their first slot. And then
wait. You said four times two is 10?
No. So you have five cards.
Oh, okay. Sorry, five times two is 10. I had to make sure there.
No. So you have five cards that each have two abilities. So it's essentially two cards in one. And so you're getting 40 cards in a 30 card deck. And that gives you a tremendous amount of consistency because you're have a bunch of two ofs. But it also gives you a tremendous amount of versatility because you can pick what you need. None of the two ofs, except for Wrath, are the same effect. I mean, Wrath is, damage or damage and draw. Right. Whereas like Living Roots is minions or damage. Mm-hmm. Nourish is draw or mana. And you go through the list and it's like, oh, all of these cards are really versatile. And so I think that beyond the Savage Roar combo, the reason that deck did so well is because it had so many really good choose cards. If you look at the Druid of the Claw, the Living Roots, the Wrath, the Nourish, and what was the other card? Ah, I just forgot it. But all of those cards made that deck really, really versatile, and it made it really, really consistent. And then you had the combo that just punched people in the face for 14.
Right.
So
it's honestly hard to get my mind back there. We've gotten so distanced from that play, that combo, that 14 health. That's where you had to get them, right?
Yeah, I was like, oh, I've got you. You're down to 14. You're dead next turn.
There was nothing worse than getting just to that point and saying, I think I'm dead. I'm dead. And there's nothing I can. I don't have a taunt. I don't have heal. I'm dead.
Yeah. The least favorite part was when you would get to 14 and then they would be like, Force of Nature. And then you quit. And you're like, I'm not even going to bother to see if they have the Savage Roar. I'm just dead here.
Because they're just playing you at that point. Yeah. But you've got something written here that says, tutors are always broken. Now, I have a feeling you're not talking about Violet Teachers here, right?
No. Okay, so there was a card in Magic called Demonic Tutor. And it said, pay two mana and search your deck for a card and put it into your hand.
Oh, wow.
And when it came out, everyone was like, oh yeah, this is okay. But what people didn't realize until later on was like, this effect is incredibly broken.
You can get whatever you want.
In every possible way. The basic core design of all collectible card games, including Hearthstone, Magic, Pokemon, everything, is randomness. You have a deck, you shuffle the deck, you don't know what you're going to pick. So if you have something that gets around that rule, no matter, almost regardless of its drawback, it is worth considering when you're building a deck. Like, so the first version in Magic was Demonic Tutor. Pay two mana, draw a card, put a card in your deck into your hand. Then they made one that was like, pay life and put a card in your hand. And that was still too powerful. And then they made pick only one kind of card. That was still too powerful. And the guys that have designed Hearthstone seem to know that really well, because the effects that are tutor-like effects that like you pick a card out of your deck are all really terrible. So like Sense Demon, King's Elec, all of those cards are really, really bad because you're putting a card from your deck into your hand at random.
And the whole point of the strength is that you get to choose exactly what you want.
Right. And so like there are ways to break the randomness. And if you can do that, this is why the Yogg-Saron Hunter deck worked, because I basically had two copies of Yogg-Saron. I had a King's Elec and Yogg-Saron. And so the King's Elec would always get the Yogg-Saron. There was no
Pretty
way
good.
It wouldn't. Yeah. And that was really good because, if it's at the end of the game and I'm losing and I have no way to come back, just play King's Elec, get Yogg-Saron, play it the next turn. And, see what happened.
Now, that made me think of the ultimate meme, which is Barnes into Yashiraj. Would you count that as a similar type of effect?
Absolutely. Okay. It's exactly the same thing. You're really sort of trimming your deck and building it in a very specific way to break a tutor effect. Mm-hmm. And this is how combo decks, this is how crazy decks always happen. If you can break a tutor, even if it's a crappy one, like a random tutor, both Barnes and King's Alec are random tutors, you can make a deck out of basically nothing. I mean, it's like you have two cards in the deck and you fill it with whatever is left, and you'll get something that works some of the time. And if I was to sit down and say, like, okay, build a crazy deck, the first thing I would do is I'd find the cards that break the conversion rate for resources. And the second thing is I would look for tutors. And if you do that and you find one that works, you're not going to be terribly disappointed. Like when Silverware Golem came out, I built a demon. It was basically a zoo deck, but instead of focusing on zoos, it was focused on all of the demons at the time. And I put 2 cents demon in, and it was basically draw 2 cards. Like every time, just draw 2 cards. And that's a really powerful effect. Even if they're, you know, not such great demons, drawing 2 cards that happen to be minions, you know, I forced the randomness to work for me, and it made the deck actually playable. I mean, there were so many times that I was like, I just need some creatures or just need some minions. Boom. Sense demon, go get those creatures, right. Put them into play. It's a terrible card, but in certain circumstances it can work.
And you know, I think about a card like Madame Goya, which is not very good, but it does a similar effect where, you know, you could build your deck around it and guarantee something out of it. So I hear you saying, like, really pay attention to cards with effects like that. And if you're able to come up with something creative, you may very well be able to break the game and come up with something incredible.
Yes. The one thing that I would add to the little list that I sent you is tutors are always broken, and in Hearthstone, charge is always broken.
That's true.
Have you seen the priest combo deck, the one turn kill priest combo deck with the Genie of Sevir?
Oh, yeah, the Disguised Host is running.
Yeah, and that that deck uses an exploit in the rules. So, like, the Potion of Madness, it doesn't say that it does this, but it gives the creature you steal charge.
Right.
And so that gives Genie of Sevir charge, and you can attack and kill somebody in one turn with the divine, what is it, the one that boosts his health, and then the one that makes his health equal to his attack.
Divine Spirit and Inner Fire.
Right. So if you have the Divine Spirit Inner Fire, you can kill somebody in one turn. So if tutors are always broken, that is certainly true in every collectible card game. But in Hearthstone, because there is no counterplay on your opponent's turn, charge is always dangerous.
Unless you're talking about the card charge, right?
Right.
Ironically, of course, the card's namesake is not very good because it forces you to not play against the face, which is exactly what you want to do.
Correct. Well, to be fair, that card has been nerfed 3 times.
Has it really?
Twice. Oh, it's been nerfed at least twice.
Wow.
So if it's been nerfed at least twice, I think it's fair to say that it was at some point a good card.
Absolutely. And I think that just goes to show just what a powerful effect it was. And I think they've done a really good job at balancing it, because even the Genie of Zephyr's combo deck isn't overpowered where it just kills anything. But it's like any combo deck where you get the exact right setup, the right draw, and boom, you can take them down immediately.
It's crazy. I had somebody do it, and I had not seen it on Disguised Host's stream. Uh-huh. I had no idea, and I was like, this guy is terrible. He's playing such an awful deck. Right. And then boom, punched me for 23. I was like, oh, yep.
That shut me up real quick.
Yeah, it was pretty fun.
Well, hey, Tony, this is a ton of really good information. If you could, like, sum it up for us, how would you bring us back through the journey that we just took with you?
All right, so pay attention to mana curve. It is the most important thing in the entire game. Maximize synergies and figure out what the high roll is for every contextually powerful card. And figure out what kind of deck you like to play, one that's consistent or one that's versatile. And then look for the 2 broken effects in the game, charge and tutors.
Very good. Man, you typed up an essay here in the show notes. So with your permission, I'd like to put this with the episode. So if you went through and you're thinking, man, what was a contextually relevant card? Again, you can go to our blog at mmoreporter.com and check out all the details. He's got a lot of the examples that he used in here and all the terminology. Man, I feel like some people are going to go out and make some cool decks with this now.
I hope so. It's so much fun. When I did the when I pulled that Khoon Kathoon combo off the first time, or when I crushed a really awesome tier one net deck with the Yogg-Saron Hunter deck, I was just, it was glee, pure glee.
And the only other thing I'll throw out there is that if deck building just isn't your thing, don't beat yourself up about it. You know, be sure that you're watching some of the streamers and professionals and just watching their deck list. You know, you can learn a lot from looking at something like the Vicious Syndicate Report, which you can just click on Dragon Priest on there and see all of the high tier Dragon Priest lists that are basically known. And you can compare and contrast them and really see, like, okay, he excluded, you know, the Bookworm out of this list, but in this one he's running a Potion of Madness. Now, why would a 1-mana and a 6-mana be exchangeable like that? And you can probably talk yourself through a lot of those things and learn a lot just from watching and looking at that information.
Yeah, one thing I would note, if you're a guy that likes to net deck and you don't think you can build a deck, go play a Jackie Chan deck, and just playing a Jackie Chan deck will teach you how to build decks.
That's true. That guy is probably one of the most genius, ridiculous out there, but actually makes stuff work. I mean, did he create Egg Druid? Is that right?
Yeah. Yep. Camel Hunter.
Oh, that's right. That was a cool deck too.
Yeah, he's so good. He's amazing.
Well, very good. Any final thoughts here before we close out deck building?
Nope. Just go have fun.
Do it. If you're not having fun, then what are you doing? You're playing a game. Come on.
Yeah.
Well, let's move to our community section. We've actually got a question here from a buddy of mine, actually from the last podcast I was a part of, Raccoon Dad. And he sent a long email. He had a history of really telling us about his experiences on the ladder. And I really love reading through what you experience. He's known for kind of hanging out on Wild mostly, and really sees a lot of success, especially getting up to rank 5 in that tier, which is really, really good. And I listened, he actually sent this email to the Valence Chosen crew also, and they answered some of his other questions. I'm not sure if they answered this part of it though, so I wanted to address it here on our show. He said, I think I should start to save gold for the next expansion now. Do we know when it should come? And like we mentioned at the top of the show, Raccoon Dad, it is going to come out around April. They did say that they're going to follow about the same release dates that they did in the past. And I would say that now is a really good time to start saving. Definitely a month out. We don't know if it's going to be April 1 or April 30. But if it is April 1, in a month, you can probably get a few thousand gold if you're really diligent in getting your quest done and all that kind of stuff. So go for it. And really, the litmus test I always use for when I should stop purchasing new packs with my gold is there anything that's legendary or epic that I still really want to play with? And I actually went through that because I had the same question, I think, a couple weeks ago. I was starting to think, man, I've bought a lot of packs at this point with my gold. It feels like I should be stopping. And I turned through my whole collection. I looked through with the crafting button on and all the stuff I don't have. And really, the only thing I was missing at that point was Finja, which isn't necessarily like a must craft card, but I was like, it'd be really fun to play with that. So I decided to go off the deep end and craft it. And then I said, you know, really, if I just keep getting packs, I'm going to be hoping for golden portraits and probably getting just dust. And that's not nearly as exciting as saving up for all of the new cards that are going to come out. So definitely would recommend that you start doing that. What's your routine like, Tony, for saving up for expansions?
So I do the exact same thing you do, except I don't do any goldens. If I get a golden, it automatically gets dusted. I don't care.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, they just go all the way. So once I have the ability to build all of the tier one or tier two decks on Tempo Storm, then I just stop and I start saving gold. The other thing that I have always done is so the packs have a pity counter on them,
right?
Which
right.
means that technically they're not truly random. If you go X number of packs without an epic or a legendary, you'll get one. They don't tell you what it is. So if you're really focused on getting a card from a particular expansion, it will take you longer and it'll take you more money if you jump around. Like if you buy a classic pack and then the new expansion, then the old expansion. So if you're looking for one card, focus on that set and buy only those cards until you get it. Because otherwise the pity counter will never reset for you. It's my understanding it was by set. So like if you bought X number of classic packs and you haven't got a legendary, but it doesn't say if you bought X number of any packs. I thought the pity counter was set specific. Huh, I may be wrong, but that's what I thought it said.
Yeah, it's hard because they really can't tell us officially how that works, because if they did, people would just exploit it, right? We do know that there is some kind of penny counter present in there so that you're not going to buy 5,000 packs and just get commons and rares the whole time, which praise Blizzard for that. But we don't know exactly how it works. So, I mean, use your best judgment, Raccoon Dad, and for everyone. But if you're excited about some dinosaurs, I would definitely be saving right about now.
Yes.
All right. No iTunes reviews this week, but man, we would love to see them. So it really helps out the show and helps us be seen visibly by people who are just looking for Hearthstone podcasts. It's the easiest, cheapest, and quickest way to support the show. So jump on iTunes or whatever app you use. If it's Google Play, we're about to get on there actually, or Stitcher or whatever. Go ahead and throw a review. Let us know what you like about the show and why other people should check it out. And we have come to one of my favorite segments of the show, Tony. It is the week time. Are you ready for this?
I'm ready.
Hit us with your best shot.
All right. Card of the week. Oh, so sweet. So good, you had to take a back seat. It's card of the week. And the card of the week is Azure Drake.
And you can explain your lyrics, because there's a lot happening with Azure Drake right now.
All right, so as part of the announcement for the Year of the Mammoth, Blizzard has decided that they're going to induct 6 cards into the Hall of Fame. And this means that the cards will only be playable in Wild, and the Hall of Fame will include the promotional cards, so the weird Tauren...
Elite Tauren Chieftain.
And Old Murkai. And it will also include 3 neutral cards and 3 classic, all these are classic set cards, and 3 class cards. And the 6 cards are Azure Drake, Sylvanas Windrunner, and Ragnaros the Fire Lord from the neutral set. And then Power Overwhelming, Ice Lance, and Conceal from the class cards. And basically what will happen is, they will all be taken out of rotation in Standard, and they will be put in this Hall of Fame set that will only be playable in Wild. And when this happens, you will automatically get the dust for each of the cards you have in their most expensive form. So if you have a gold Azure Drake, you will get the dust for the gold Azure Drake. If you have a gold Azure Drake and a regular Azure Drake, you will just get the dust for the gold Azure Drake.
That's actually a little bit off. They said that as many can be put into one deck, they'll give you the dust back. So yeah, if you have one golden Azure Drake and one regular, you'll get the dust for each of those. But if you have more than that, let's say you have one golden Azure Drake and 2 regular Azure Drakes, you're only going to get the dust for the golden Azure Drake and 1 of the regular Azure Drakes.
That is awesome.
Yeah, that's pretty nice, right? It's generous.
And you don't have to dust them. That was the thing that was so crazy. They're just giving it to you.
And I'm so thankful that they did this. They talked about the reasons why, and they said, if we incentivized you to dust these cards, we'd in fact be incentivizing you to not play Wild, which is counterintuitive if we're trying to support this format. So this is, again, one of those I think back to when Mean Streets was released and they had that problem with the booster packs that were coming out. You remember?
Where they screwed up the rarities.
Yeah. Lots of tri-class cards were getting out. And what they decided to do was reimburse people a third of the packs they had opened, which they didn't have to do. Like, even though it was a mistake, Everyone got cards that they paid for, right? And they just decide to give us packs for free. So something like this is the same thing where just because they think, or excuse me, they think, just because they are making a good decision that I agree with about these cards, doesn't mean that they are obligated to give us something in return, and certainly not for holding on to the cards. We're getting free dust. That's incredibly generous.
They're really, really great. They're one of the, I mean, I've followed closely a ton of different companies in a ton of different places, and there is no company that does better fan service than Blizzard. And I say that not only because of how they handle the game, but for all sorts of other reasons, having dealt with them in different ways than just playing games. They are really, really amazing.
Now, why did you pick Azure Drake out of all of these Hall of Famers?
All right. So when I first started, like everybody, you get a free mage deck, and you don't have to unlock all the stuff.
Right. Right.
You get stuff right away. And the mage deck was pretty awful. what was the Archmage? I forget the 4/7 for five that has Archmage, spell damage. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Guy's terrible. and I was always like, I just need like a little something extra. Mm-hmm. I wish this card did something extra. And one of the things that's really amazing about Hearthstone, and is a testament to how good the team is that even the worst cards in Hearthstone are still pretty good. You know, there are very few cards that are just like completely unplayable. Like Scott's least favorite card, Poison Seeds.
Right. Like
Poison Seeds is not horrendous, especially if you compare. Well, okay. So like here's my baseline. There were like, coming from Magic to Hearthstone, there were cards in Magic that had no positive effects.
Okay.
Like there was a card that that was just a more expensive version of an already bad card. Mm-hmm. Or there was another card where you could switch, like suppose there was a minion battle, you could switch which one of your minions was in the battle, mm-hmm. but it did damage to you and to the minion.
So
it was like, it was just, they were just terrible. And, you know, Magic has 20,000 or 25,000 different cards at this point. Uh-huh. And a full, probably a quarter or maybe a sixth of them are just completely unplayable.
Crazy.
And so the idea that like the worst card in that deck was that Archmage, going from that to Azure Drake made that deck so much better because everything is so tight. The power is really close on all these cards. So if you get a card that's significantly better, it makes the whole deck significantly better. Hmm. And the number of cards that you have is only 30 in a deck. And so Azure Drake, putting that card in the deck and getting two of them really transformed how good that deck was. And right. it made playing the ladder fun for me. So I will always have a soft spot in my heart for Azure Drake.
Man, and it's such an auto include in so many different decks, right? I mean, this was one of the first cards I would ever recommend that somebody craft for a deck because it fits in so many. I mean, you get the spell damage, you get to draw a card. Dragon decks love this, you know. So there's so many different situations where Azure Drake will get you so much value, and I think that, you know, the big reason why they're moving all six of these cards over to Wild and into a Hall of Fame is because they've become like a benchmark for especially the minions here for that cost of a minion. So if you need a 5-cost minion for whatever deck you're playing, Azure Drake's a really good choice. If you need a 6-mana card minion, Sylvanas is a great choice, and same for Ragged 8. So they really want to open up the deck building component for those different spaces because there are other 8-mana or 6-mana cost minions that aren't necessarily bad. It's just nothing can beat the effect that you get off of Sylvanas or off of Rag. And so those have become so evergreen, auto includes to everything, that if they keep being on standard will not be as fresh as it could. But now moving over, I think what's so brilliant about this is we'll still be able to play them on Wild, and I think you got even more incentive to go hang out at Wild now with this change. But Standard is going to get a lot fresher. You're going to see a lot more different cards over there, and it's going to make the game more fun, I think.
Oh, yeah, I completely agree. I think that two things that I would add to this is, first, if we were not in a time period in which Paladin was terrible, Mm-hmm. I could easily see Tyrion being on this list because he is substantially better than any of the other 8-cost cards in the game. I mean, if you think about like Forbidden Shaping, the priest card that lets you spend all your mana to get, you know, a man, like eight mana slot is so good. And it's so good because of Ragnaros and Tyrion.
Sure, sure.
You know, like Tyrion in Ostakaka's Secret Paladin. I mean, that card was insane.
It's just so good. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think that if we were in a time period where like Secret Paladin was still good, that Tyrion might be on this list. And then the other thing that I noticed was they're taking out a 6-mana card in Sylvanas Windrunner.
Uh-huh.
And they have this really awesome Highlander effect around another 6-mana card. So it would be pretty fun. I have no reason to think they're doing this, but it would be fun if they added Reno Jackson to the basic set.
Now I'm pretty sure at some point I heard Ben Brode say directly that Reno is not going to be rotated.
Ugh, and I don't, so good.
I don't want to be too bold about that because I can't remember where, but I'm pretty sure I read that at one point.
You know, like those decks are fun decks to play. They're hard decks to play, and I think they're good for the game. And it's not quite to the point where it's like if you don't draw Reno, you die. But having Reno and Kazakus, or having Reno and Ink Mage Soldier, or having all of them, it makes those decks really fun. And I like that effect in the game, and having it as part of the basic set. I don't know. I mean, they know more about the game than we do because they have so much data.
But well, and I think it's always hard to say goodbye to an old friend, you know, or to realize that you won't get to play with, you know, those Azure Drakes again or with Reno again. But I think from where they're thinking, there are certain cards that they can't make because they would be too overpowered with those in the same design space. Now, granted, the great thing is that they created Wild for this exact reason. So if you ever want to hang out with these guys, they're fine. They're right over there, right?
Yeah.
But I think it'll be interesting to see what they come out with, especially with Mean Streets, where they expanded the Highlander style of deck with Kazakus, Inkmaster Solia, and Raz of the Chained and all those. So I'm sure that they will keep adding those style cards to the game, but maybe they won't be quite as powerful because there's no doubt Reno can flip the game just by being the right draw. And on the other side, if you're playing the Reno deck and you cannot draw him, you're so frustrated because it's your win condition. But I think it's nice to have that balance where you want something fresh, go hang out at Standard. You want to be rich, you can go to Wild and hang out with him there.
It will make them feel more different than they feel right now.
Yes, absolutely. Well, very cool, man. Well, as we close out the show, I want to tell you guys that Happy Hearthstone is a proud part of the MMO Reporter Network, which is a collaboration of several different podcasts that are all on mission to provide fun and entertaining takes on your favorite games. So if you're not just a Hearthstone player, but you also play WoW, LOTRO, Guild Wars, or any other MMO, be sure to go to MMO Reporter and check out some of the other great podcasts there. In fact, I saw Chris, he's one of the main hosts of MMO Reporter, was digging into some Conan Exiles on the Twitch stream the other day. So you definitely want to go check that out if you're into any of that stuff. And if you'd like to support our show and help us grow, you can make a financial contribution at patreon.com/MMOReporter. Those patrons are awesome, and there's some great benefits for joining in what we're doing. And as always, we'd love to know what you thought of the show, what you'd like to see added to future episodes. So you can join our awesome communities at Google+. Just search for Happy Hearthstone or the links in the show notes. You can follow me on Twitter at AndrewsLiving or follow the show at TheHappyHS. You can also email the show, thehappyhearthstone@gmail.com. If you have any questions, show ideas, if you want to be a co-host like the awesome Tony on here, just hit me up there. And definitely as you're going out and maybe building some decks and trying to come up with something creative, feel free to send it in and I'd love to take a look at it, maybe make some suggestions and stuff like that. And we'd love to keep going there. You can also find all of our shows at mmoreporter.com, as well as the MMO Reporter YouTube. I also want to remind you guys that every Monday night we'll be doing a stream at twitch.tv/mmoreporter. Been having a blast with everyone hanging out there. So this Monday night, 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. Central, would love to hang out with you. I might have a great time if you're there, basically, is what I mean to say. And also, last call, but our art contest is going to end at the end of this month. So if you have an idea for the logo and would like to see that fresh coat of paint, send it in. Send it in to thehappyhearthstone@gmail.com, and I would love to see an homage to what was, or something brand new that you would like to take on. Again, March 1st is going to be the deadline for those. And Tony, I know you've plugged before on the show, but please plug us again. Tell us about where we can find all of your knives and hermits and everything like that.
So you can find me over at everydaycommentary.com. You can find the podcast that I do, Gear Geeks Live, at geargeekslive.com. It's also in the iTunes. I am Everyday Comment on Twitter and Everyday Commentary on Instagram.
Very nice. What kind of stuff are you Instagramming these days?
95% of it is pictures of what I carried in my pocket that day, which is usually a pocket knife, a flashlight, and a pen. For people that like everyday carry stuff, if you do like hashtag EDC, you'll find millions of people photographing the contents of their pocket, which really sounds weird. Oh God, it's crazy.
I feel like you have to be really sophisticated to like have just the right pen or just the right knife or something like that.
It's taken me a long time to find my favorite pen. And as somebody that writes every day, mm-hmm. having a nice pen that works well is really, 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 really fun. It makes the day easier to get through.
I always wanted my parents to buy me one of those Beak pens that had the gel where you would hold the pen. And I thought that was just they went for the 20 pens for a nickel.
Dr. Grip?
Yeah, that's a Dr. Grip. I think they bought me one time, and man, that was, I felt powerful with that pen.
I remember being in seventh grade and be like, I got the Dr. Grip.
Oh, man.
This is awesome.
Whew, well, this has been a throwback. But Tony, thanks so much for joining us again, man. I really appreciate you bringing your expertise and helping us all become better and hopefully able to do even more within the game.
All right. Well, Andrew, thanks for having me on. This is super fun. I've loved listening to the show, and I think you've done a really good job transitioning it into a new chapter.
Absolutely. Well, we're always going to be looking towards what's ahead and making things better. So I really appreciate that, man. That means the world. And thank you guys for hanging out with us, visiting the Happy Hearthstone, and having a little fun with us. We'll see you guys next time.